All right, so we're going to go back into this again. And remember, we're not going to go all the way through this, but go down there towards the bottom as Jesus now is making his journey towards Jerusalem, knowing, as I've said 100 times, where the destiny will take him, to the cross. He has set his face. He's going to Jerusalem knowing full well the hostility, the condemnation, the criticism, the opposition, fill in the blank that awaits him there as he confronts those who are the quote-unquote religious of the day. He knows full well that he's going to be rejected, and yet he has set his face. That's why Luke was so driving that point home to us so importantly. So we looked at this last section here, starting in chapter 12, and you can see it goes all the way through chapter 22. But he now begins to prepare his people. He did that first. We just concluded with this last week about in chapter 12. We saw that the kingdom, as Jesus presented the kingdom to those same religious people who were supposed to be looking and waiting for the kingdom, but instead were keeping people out of the kingdom. And then they ended up rejecting him. And that leads, as we're going to see here in just a few minutes, to some pretty stern pronouncements from Jesus against those people. But anyway, the kingdom was rejected. It was offered, and then it was rejected to the people of Israel. And then Jesus followed that up, giving a whole series of warnings that we looked at as we journeyed through chapter 13. And when we came to the conclusion of that chapter last week, the result of the rejection of Messiah and not heeding the warnings of Jesus, Jesus said, "And now your house is left to you desolate." You want to play the religious game? This is where it will end up. And there's desolation. Remember, abandonment. Desolation means abandon. In other words, I, as your Messiah that you have rejected, will now abandon you to your own whims. And we know that a few years later, those same religious people that he's talking to today ceased to exist, just like he said they would. There hasn't been a Pharisee since 70 AD. There hasn't been a scribe or a Sadducee since 70 AD. Okay, there's been a mess because those people were sent all over the world, and that's where we find them today. So as we're journeying through this, we're going to turn a corner now. And what Jesus is going to do is he's going to move from warning his people to now instructing his people. Okay, and here's what it means now to have a kingdom perspective. Okay, but as he does that, there's one last time that he's going to find himself sitting with the Pharisees, with the religious of the day. And once again, just like always, they're going to doubt, they're going to question, they're going to condemn, they're going to do everything just like they always do with him. And he's going to once again speak the truth and speak it forth profoundly and powerfully, and he's going to put them once again in their place. Okay, but before we get to that, let's look at the journey. We saw, first of all, back in 11, that they rejected their Messiah by accusing him of being in cahoots with Satan himself. This brought Jesus' condemnation to both the Pharisees, the keeper of the traditions, okay, and the scribes, or some of your translations say lawyers, those that were responsible to make sure that what was done lined up with the very scripture that they were supposed to support. And Jesus condemned both groups with 6 woes. Woe to the Pharisees 3 times, and woe to the scribes. Now, woe means that they're coming under judgment for that because they had rejected him. We know this to be true because they ultimately said, "You have done this. The ministry that you're doing is by the power of Lucifer." What a sad, pathetic display of where religion ultimately leads. But then it got worse. Their false teaching was permeating the people of the day. And it caused that generation, which Jesus called the generation in which they lived, an evil and wicked generation. It was evil and wicked because the teaching of these guys had permeated within the community. And that's why there were so few followers of the true Messiah when he came to earth. He called it the leaven of the Pharisees. Leaven permeates. Remember, yeast is what is being talked about here. And that leaven of that false teaching, Jesus went on to say, there's nothing that hidden that will not be revealed. And he's talking about that false teaching. because it's within that same context. And then also, as we talked about last week and we just touched on, that this false teaching, initiated by the religious, embraced by the people as it permeated the people, will ultimately lead to destruction, which is the verse we just talked about, the first part of it. And now your house is left desolate. There is the result. Okay? And then his final pronouncement on them at the end of chapter 13, before we jump into 14, which is where we're headed. And he said to them, "You will see me no more until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" Now remember, this is not the triumphal entry. It's not. We're talking about a period of time when they recognize what they have done, as the prophet Zechariah said, quoting the Lord, "And then they will look upon me," Yahweh is speaking, "and then they will look upon me whom they have pierced, and they will mourn for him as one mourns for a son." The prophet Zechariah, chapter 12, verse 10. That's Jesus said, "You will not see me again until you recognize what you have done, until you call out for me." And that's what he said. So that ends the Jesus' teaching and preparing his people, and the idea of warning that the religion will keep you out of the kingdom. But then he moves into now chapter 14, and this is going to go all the way through chapter 22. Following a sequence of warnings, the rest from this chapter 14, all the way through chapter 2, now is going to be a sequence of instruction. And remember, Jesus' sole purpose was to bring the kingdom. "I am here," Jesus said when he was there, "the kingdom is here." And they missed it. And he's going to condemn them once again further down the road when we get over to chapter 19. But he's going to begin to teach them, to instruct them now. Remember, there were his followers following him, smaller group, the apostles, the 12, those that had a specific and unique ministry. Okay, and then the bigger group, which were called disciples, of which, of course, the apostles would also be called disciples, and are sometimes. But they were specifically chosen for a specific purpose, and that's why they're called, and they only hold that title, apostolos, apostle, okay? Now, look at what's going to happen here, because the first thing, having said those statements, Jesus has made those statements about your house is left to you desolate. Remember, as he was journeying between the villages, back in chapter 13, we read that. And so now he's brought this warning upon them. And now he's invited once again, one last attempt, and this will be the last time, that we'll see that once again the Pharisees, as they always do, thinking high and mighty as they were, that they understood, once again invite him to the house for a setup. They're going to set him up, and they're once again going to show that he is not who he claims to be. But they're quick to find out that they, like those that invited him before, are going to be wrong. Okay? So let's take a look at this. And this section of this is the instruction on restoration. Now let's look at the first four verses here. "Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees." So that's clearly where he's at. So this is happening now as he's going from town to town, village to village, on his way from Galilee through Perea, which we call Jordan, on the east side of the Jordan River. And he's going to come down through Perea, and he's going to come into Judea, which is where Jerusalem is at. And just before he crosses into that area, Judea, on his way to Jerusalem, there's a Pharisee, obviously, that is a ruler. So he's a big dog, we would call him, and he's invited into this house on the journey. So it happened. I love how Luke does that. "Now it just so happened." It's amazing to me that he puts this out. "Now it happened as he went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, that they watched him closely." Oh, so already you know something is up. They're watching. They're trying to trap him. "And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy." Notice where the man is before. He's before Jesus. The guy invites Jesus to the house. Jesus goes into the house, and lo and behold, as he gets in there, what's confronting him? A man with dropsy. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. "And Jesus answered," obviously recognizing it, "he answered and he spoke to the lawyers and the Pharisees." So there you have the scribes and the Pharisees. So we know this was a group of the big dogs. okay, a pack, so to speak, of the religious of the day. And he recognizes this, and you can see, and now he sees the man, but clearly he turns back to the religious, to the Pharisees and the scribes, and he asks them a question. Ah, I see what's going on here. So let me ask you, Mr. Pharisee, Mr. Scribe, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Oh. Now, if you're a scribe or a Pharisee, you know dang good and well it's not illegal to do that. Deuteronomy chapter 5 should tell you. And if you're one who understands the Torah, and you're one that understands and proclaims it, then you should understand that Deuteronomy chapter 5 is going to allow him to do just what he's getting ready to do. That even on a Sabbath, you take care of your animals, you take care of your family. And he's just now put them on the spot. See, they were convinced once again that they had him. Because the law of God is clear. The spirit of the law is the person, not the day. But their tradition had changed it to where the day became the priority. So he speaks to them and he asks them the question. Now look at the response, as you would expect, but they kept silent. And he took him, that is the man with dropsy, and he healed him. And notice now, he let him go. Interesting. Now what the heck is going on here? As we said, he's been invited in. There's a setup. We're going to nail this guy. Because we know who he claims to be. And it's impossible for him to be who he claims to be, even though our scriptures would say otherwise. You see, these people that claim to know the scriptures rejected the very scriptures they claim to know. That's how they didn't recognize him. And that's why he was so frustrated with them and so heartbroken. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Remember he said that? You who kill the prophets and stone those that are sent to you. Who's he talking to? The people? No. The Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees. The religious. Because they were the ones with the authority to condemn to the point of stoning someone else. So he's saying this to them. But he's crying out, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you guys. And then he says, how many times, remember last week, how many times would I gather you to myself and protected you like a mother hen, but you wouldn't come? There's the verdict on the religious of the day. And you know what? That verdict exceeds to even our day. So as they call him there, notice that in verse 2, that behold, there was a certain man before him. As I said, this is clearly, they bring him into the situation because you don't go into somebody's house, especially a religious ruler, without an invite. And that's going to become really the focus of where Jesus is going to go with this later. But they invite him in, and the minute that he walks in, obviously they're seated in a different place, because as he comes in, he's confronted not with them, but with the man that's there to be set up. Now this isn't the first time, is it? Remember back when he was up around the Sea of Galilee in his northern ministry? They did the same thing up there, didn't they? The Pharisee and the leader of the synagogue there tried to set him up too on a Sabbath. They brought a man in who had a withered hand, remember? And they set up and they were watching him to see whether or not he would heal, because you see, to heal is to work, and you can't work on the Sabbath. Again, Deuteronomy 5, never mentioned. Imagine that. But that wasn't even the first time. There was another time, remember, we just read about it back again in chapter 13, where they brought in a woman, this time, who was so bent over with a spirit of darkness. And they brought in again to watch to see what Jesus would do. And we saw the outburst when he healed. You can't heal on the Sabbath. You got to heal on all of the other 6 days. Obviously, they had failed. The hypocrisy of these people knows no bounds. It's tragic. It's absolutely tragic. All of the hostility that faced Jesus came from them. Even the cahoots and the problems that Rome had with him, because it was those guys stirring this junk up. What a sad commentary. Now, what's interesting, so this man now is brought, put right before him, and he's a man who has dropsy. And what the heck is dropsy? Well, you and I would call it edema. The gathering of fluid in your joints, specifically in the extremities. So, you, in other words, a lot of fluid would collect, you know. So typically this is associated with congestive heart failure, COPD, things of that nature. So obviously this was a sick man. That was obvious to everybody that he had whatever disease and whatever his signs and symptoms were. And they saw this guy. And these Pharisees, the wonderful Pharisees used the man, not because of his sickness, but to trap the Lord. What a great commentary again, huh? And behold, there was a man who had dropsy. Now, what's interesting, Luke is the only one that tells us this story. And now that shouldn't surprise us, because who is Luke? Number one, he's not a Jew, he's a Gentile. What else is Luke? He's a doctor. He's a physician. It would only be a physician who would say, and this person had edema. Everybody else would go, he was sick. He had issues. We don't know what they were. But only Luke. It's really interesting, because remember when we started our gospel, we said that Luke has takes a unique perspective on who Jesus is. Because again, he's a Gentile. He's not a Jew. And he's a doctor. And so because he's a Gentile, he looks at people that Matthew, Mark, and John, you know, it isn't that they didn't care about him. It just wasn't their focus. Their focus was on the Jews and Jesus' ministry to the Jews. But not Luke. Luke is the one that keeps telling us about all of the women and all of the children and all of those things. Because, you see, it would be important to a person like Luke. And he would point this kind of thing out. So there was a certain man for him who had dropsy, and of course we know, and then Jesus answering. And I love this, because you have to try to picture these things in your mind. As they walk him in and they seat in a certain way when you go into those homes. They didn't just hang out, okay? And typically they didn't have tables. Remember, they sat on floors, on mats, but they would position themselves. And depending on where you were at, you know, if you were the big dog and the most important, probably the richest at the place, you would get the seat of honor at seat number one. And then it would just go down from there. And the person that invited you would take the seat of the lowest. To say there were nine people, he would take seat number nine in honor of his guests. But notice that we're not told where Jesus is seated. Isn't it interesting? The rest of them are seated because we're going to see that Jesus looks around at where they're seated. But right now, we haven't seen that yet. But as Jesus walks into this thing, as by invitation, keep that in mind, he walks in, and the minute he walks in there, he's confronted with this poor man who all of the others care nothing about. And as he sees this, obviously knowing hearts and minds as Jesus does, he turns, and Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and the Pharisees. He redirected his conversation. Oh, let me ask you guys a question. And he puts them on the spot. You're supposed to know the Torah. Let's see how well you know it. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now, they should have been able to answer that. These were the religious leaders of the country. They should have, with a resounding yes, said absolutely, absolutely. The spirit of the law is the concern and the care for people, especially those who are in bad situations, and to even take care of animals that God has provided for you. That's clearly what the law taught. That's the spirit of the law. But the letter of the law, if you remove the spirit, becomes no, you can't do anything on the Sabbath. And he knew that they couldn't answer, because to answer would have been to condemn themselves. And we see the result, but they kept silent. They kept silent. And I love what Jesus does. In spite of their silence, which I would equate to arrogance, in spite of their silence, notice what he does. He turns back to the man, him, whoever him is. We don't know who this is. And he does just exactly what he said he's going to do. It is lawful to heal on the Sabbath. And I'm going to heal on the Sabbath. And there's nothing that you can do about it. Remember just a few days before this, Herod, Antipas, had sent a group of guys, Pharisees, again, telling Jesus, get out of my land or I'm going to come and kill you. And Jesus said, what did he say? You remember that? You tell that slimy weasel, fox, right? You tell that fox that I'm here and I'm going to continue to heal. And I'm going to continue to stand against the enemies of spiritual darkness and tell him I have no fear of him in any way, shape, or form. Go back and tell him I said so. Well, he's doing precisely what he told him he would do. He heals the man. And he healed him. And I love the last phrase. And he let him go. Now, what does that tell you? That the man was probably there against his will. In essence, the Pharisees had forced this man to come in and were keeping him captive so that they could try to nail this upstart young Jew from Galilee named Jesus. But Jesus has just done the unthinkable, hasn't he? And rather than him binding this poor individual, he not only heals him, he lets him go. He turns him loose. And we're not told, but isn't it interesting to wonder what this guy did? Can you imagine? Made a beeline, bolted out the door, probably jumping and praising God that he had been healed by the very one his religious leaders were now trying to bring false accusations against. Unbelievable. That's just absolutely amazing. And then he turns back, now that the man has been healed and set free. And then he answered them saying, now let me ask you a question, Mr. Pharisee, Mr. Scribe, which of you having a donkey or an ox? Oh, we've heard this before, haven't we? This is the excuse that he always used. I mean, come on, there's value in an ox. There's value in a donkey. They carried the load of the day. They were the pickups of the day, the SUVs. See, great value in those things. And he says, now which of you, having one of these things, and if the thing falls into a pit on the Sabbath, which one of you will not immediately pull him out, even if it is a Sabbath? Well, he knew precisely what they would do. They would go immediately and restore and rescue this thing. Do you see what he's challenging them with? You see what's happened here, Mr. Pharisee, Mr. Scribe? You place more value on the Sabbath than you do on the people. And in that, you were wrong. And later he would say, or actually earlier, he had said, man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath, which literally means only rest. The rest that God initiated was meant for man. It was to take care of the man. And yet, you wouldn't have a problem doing anything for your ox or your servant, for your pickup or your SUV on this day. But on one of your brothers, your priorities are big messed up. Big messed up. That's ultimately what he's saying. And they could not answer him concerning these things. Isn't it interesting how truth silences? And again, who's being silenced? Those who should have known. Those who understand. Now the next thing, so the idea of restoration here is that you guys have got to get your priorities straight. The restoration of a human being who, because of the fall, is suffering, that is your priority, not a day. Get a clue. But then he's going to turn. And now, because the guy is gone and he's in the midst of this invitation with all these people seated in their rooms, notice what happens now in verse 7, and he's going to move now to exaltation, the idea of putting yourself in a position where everybody can see not only who you are, but what you are. Verse 7 now. So he told a parable. Now, what's interesting about this, I want to take just a couple of seconds here. He's told parables before leading up to this, but they have been few. But remember, they've rejected the gospel. He has proclaimed condemnation on them, desolation, abandonment for who they are. That would ultimately take place just a few years after him. He has already done that. So what he's going to do now is he's going to turn, and much of the instruction that he's going to give from this point on is going to be done in these things that we call parables. Para means to come or stand alongside. Bale means to throw. Or to cast. So these parables are stories that are cast alongside. Well, what are they cast alongside? They're cast alongside earthly understanding. In other words, when he uses a parable, he's going to use something that they're familiar with. Okay, so it's got a physical reality, but there's a spiritual truth that's cast alongside. In other words, so there's more than the physical going on. And remember earlier on, the apostles had come to Jesus when he first initiated this kind of teaching, and they said, how come you speak it in parables? And what was Jesus' reply to them? Because to you, it is given to know the truth, but to those that won't heed, the truth is hidden. And then he quotes from the Old Testament, and he said, so that even though they see, they cannot perceive. And even though they hear, they will not listen. In other words, spiritual truth is kept apart from those who willingly choose to blind their eyes to it, who willingly choose to not hear it. That's why at times when he's using parables, he would say, let him who has ears hear. Are you one that's in tune with the spiritual truth and reality that has just been shared? Or are you one through your own foolishness can't hear and can't see? That's what he's talking about. So he told a parable to those who were invited. Now, this word invited is very significant. We're going to see it, 12 times as we go through verse 24. Now, why is it important? Because for those people in Jesus' day, an invitation was given by somebody, okay, for you to come and to partake of something that they were preparing for you. Whether it be a supper or a dinner, or in fact a much broader perspective on these things called feasts. Okay? But an invitation was very significant. Because it was given to all of those that were important to the one doing the inviting. And when you responded to that, you came to holding that invitation. And you were, this was your sort of your, entry pass. Ticket to get in, so to speak. You would carry this with you. So in other words, you had been picked by the person doing the inviting. And then when you got there, everything was provided for you. Okay? So it's important to understand this, because this word invite is going to keep jumping up repeatedly as we move through this. In fact, 12 times, as I already said. So he told a parable to those who were invited. Well, who were those invited within this context? The scribes and the Pharisees. The scribes and the Pharisees, the lawyers and the Pharisees. And they were all invited by a chief of the Pharisees, one of the leaders of the Pharisees. So that's who was. Now notice this. He told a parable to those who were invited. Watch. When he noted how they chose the best places. Because see, that's what happened when you got an invitation. If you were really important, you got a seat of honor. If you're not so much, you were still invited, but you had to sit in one of the seats at the back. You see? And Jesus notes this because he's the Lord and he knows precisely what's going on here. They brought this man in. Obviously, the man wasn't seated or he'd still be in his seat. What's interesting about this is, where was Jesus seated? We don't even read that he did sit, do we? We don't even know. Isn't it interesting to think that they didn't even have the gall to offer him a seat? Whether it was a seat of honor or a seat of humility. Either way, it's interesting. But he notices those, and he notices those who were in the best places. Now, we can tell by this seating who's Mr. 1, Mr. 2, and Mr. 3, right? How pathetic. This is what these folks had gotten to. So he notes this. And he noticed how, again, an invitation has gone out, and then there's the seating arrangements. And notice what happens. And then he says to them, listen, and here's our word again. When you were invited by anyone, now notice what's happening. What's he been invited to? A supper. This is not a supper. This is a feast that he's going to be talking about. Now, they would have understood, as we should understand, that the feast, whenever Jesus uses it, he's talking about that celebration of being in his kingdom. Okay? So it's a kingdom feast that's in focus. Now we know that because one of the guys at the table is going to recognize it. But for now, we need to understand. But notice what he says. When you were invited by anyone to a wedding feast, see, this is a wedding feast. So it's a feast following a wedding. So he's upped the ante some. Because the wedding feast is not the wedding ceremony. So there's already a ceremony that has taken place. And I think he left that out intentionally because the wedding ceremony would be for his bride, the body of Christ. But for these guys, they would be invited guests to the feast if they chose to respond to the invite. So when you are invited to by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest one more honorable you than you be invited. This guy's carrying an invitation too. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, you know what, dude, give place to this guy. Because, you know, he's more important than you. So it's the equivalent of basically coming in here and Jesus saying, you know what, you guys in the front row, you shouldn't sit in the front row. Because the reality is there are people behind you that are more important than you. And I don't want to have to come down there and say, Johnny, what are you doing in the front row, dude? You need to move back. You need to move back. Okay? Carol and Bill hold more authority than you, and they should be sitting up front. So I'm going to ask you to move back a few rows. That's terrible. That's what's happening here. Isn't that pathetic? But that's what's happening. That's what he's talking about. He's saying, listen, when you go in here, even if you, you know, you just take the back seat. Just relax, man. Relax. And he who invited you, come and say to you, well, listen, you know what? Give place to this guy because he's more important to you. And then you begin to feel shame because now you got to stand up in front of everybody and go, oops, probably shouldn't have sat in the front row. So, by the way, that's why people don't sit in the front row. You ever notice that? Well, except right here. Plus, they know the guy that's teaching has a tendency to spit and drool and stuff. So, you know, nobody wants to sit in the front. But anyway, but then in verse 10, but when you are invited, go and sit at the back row, at the lowest place. So that when he who invites you comes and says, no, listen to me. Friend, you're special to me. Come forward. You see? So that when the friend comes to you and says, no, come up higher, then you will have glory in the presence. In other words, people will go, oh, those guys got a good relationship. You see? Now, the other side of this is, do you understand that there can also be some great self-exaltation even in humility? Let me explain what I mean. You can come into a place knowing that you're really important and say, so what I'm going to do, even though I know I'm sort of cream of the crop, I'm going to take the back seat. Now, folks, that's not real humility, okay? Because you want to be seen by everybody as the person says, oh, no, you're much too important to sit in the back. Well, yeah, I just thought I'd be humble enough to sit in the back. Please, as you walk forward to your new seat, right? Give me a break. Oh, Lord, I'm so humble. No, you're not, or you wouldn't have just said that. You know? It's just like I said before, one of these days I'm going to write a book. Humility and how I achieved it. It'll be a million seller. Right? Ay. I'll have pictures in it, because I don't like books without pictures. So, but you see what's going on here? He's shaming them for what they've done. How dare you guys? You come in here and you sit in these positions as if it was some really big thing, and you brought this guy in, didn't even give him a seat, didn't even mention there or have any concern at all for the condition that he was in. And he said, that is absolute absurdity. Your thinking is wrong. In fact, when your thinking should be that, you know what, I will seat in the lowest place. Because though I may be a man of position, I consider other people more important than myself. Isn't that the New Testament principle? Always putting the other person first? Of course it is. So basically, he's smacking them around, is what it amounts to. And you can just imagine these guys sitting there with their mouths wide open, and they are completely silent. That's the interesting thing to me. Until Jesus goes on to say in verse 11 now, for whoever, here's the pattern, guys, that you guys that even should, you know, that are supposed to know the Torah, you should know this, because this is taught, I mean, I can't tell you, I should have counted them, but this statement is made throughout the scripture, Old and New Testament, like 20 plus times. So this is not a new teaching. In other words, you guys should have known this. For whoever exalts himself, lifts himself up, will be humbled. But he who humbles himself will be exalted. Then he also said to him who invited him, now he makes a beeline to the guy himself, the Pharisee. When you give a dinner, next time, I would love to add that, but anyways, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your brothers, your relatives, nor rich neighbors. Because you know if you do, they're going to invite you back and you're going to be repaid. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. Invite your friends and your family, unless they eat a whole lot. Then have them bring their own stuff, but you get the idea. No, no, Jesus says in verse 13, but so in opposite, in contrast, that no, no, when you give a feast, notice he's at a supper, he's talking to a guy who invited him to a supper, but he's going back to the feast concept. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, you know, like the guy that you set me up with. Clearly, he hadn't been invited. This proves it. But these are the people that you should invite, because they're ones that don't get this opportunity, and you know full well can never repay you. So which do you think is going to be more blessed by the invitation? And interestingly enough, we're going to talk about these group here in just a couple of minutes. I don't want to spend too much time, but the poor, the maimed, and the lame, and the blind. Remember that these Pharisees considered those people cursed by God. They wouldn't touch them, wouldn't come near the sick. They wouldn't do it. Because after all, God's judgment is upon them. You know, oh, so we don't want to do anything there. How pathetic. Unbelievable. Verse 13, but when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and then you'll be blessed. Because they cannot repay you, for you shall be repayed when? At the resurrection. Oh, it's not going to look, may not look really good for you now, bringing all these derelicts to your house for a dinner. But make no mistake about it, I won't forget. And when the resurrection comes, that's when you're going to be blessed and you're going to be honored. Notice verse 15. Now when one of those who sat at the table, he'd just been talking to the guy that invited him, and now somebody else at the table, one of those who sat at the table with him, notice this, he knows, just what I said, that Jesus is talking about the kingdom. When he heard these things, that man says to Jesus, oh, blessed is he who shall eat bread in the kingdom of God. But what did he just miss? That those people that were not invited, according to Jesus, would be there as well. Notice that he's saying, oh, I'm going to be there. I don't need an invitation. Why? Because he's a religious leader. He's a Pharisee or a scribe, whichever group he, category he found himself under. We don't know. But either way, notice, didn't say, blessed is he who is invited to eat bread. No, no. Blessed is he who shall eat bread. That's me. That's us. So to that, then, Jesus gives another parable, and this one is going to deal with invitation, and then we'll be out of here. Then he said to him, listen, a certain man gave a great supper, and he invited many. Here's the request. This man, who obviously possesses a lot, has sent out an invitation, and the invitation has gone out to many people. That's the request. And he sent his servant, verse 17, at supper time to say to those who were invited, all things are now ready. Oh, there's a clue in that. The certain man is God, the Father. The servant is Jesus Christ, the Son. God has prepared. Notice the last phrase, all things are now ready. In other words, now that everything is prepared, those that already know it's being prepared, go tell them now's the time. Oh. Not only had Jesus come as the servant, but God had sent the prophets before them. Well, we already know what kind of reception they received, don't we? You who killed the prophets and stoned those who were sent to you. So they know that there's an invitation. It was customary for the Jew, you send out an initial invitation, much like we did today, to something, and you tell people when it's going to be. This was their culture. Then you would prepare for those people to come, make everything ready and available, and then you would send the second invitation to invite those people to come. Okay? That's kind of how, that's how they did it. That was their culture. That's what they did. But notice what happens to the request. It's rejected. It's rejected. Now they know full well who he's talking about here. He's talking about them. Because they had had the prophets. And now the key servant, the Son of God, was there also inviting him. But notice what happens now, starting in verse 18. But. The request has gone out. All things are ready. But. They all with one accord began to make excuses. Well, the kingdom's been prepared for us. We know that. But you know what? Not really interested in the kingdom. And here's what they do. Now, we're all familiar with this, or most of us at least. The first one said to the son, the servant sent, and you know also to those that came before him, but this is speaking to this about the servant. Well, listen, I bought a piece of ground, and I must go and see it. And so I ask you to have me excused. And what's the first problem you see in there? I. This guy is not interested in the invitation. He's interested in his own self-interests. I. This man is a fool. First of all, do you buy a piece of land without first of all looking at it? Only if you're a moron. Okay? Dude, got this killer piece of land. It's in scenic. I love scenic, don't get me wrong. And you're writing to this guy in Florida, listen, just buy this 10 acres from me, man. It's just abundant with water. There are trees. There are beautiful bushes. And the dude in Florida's going, really? Really? Okay. Yeah, I'll buy that. That's what this guy is saying. Wait a minute. I bought a piece of ground. Well, now I must go and see it. Shouldn't you have probably seen it before you bought it, you fool? Nobody would do that. But there's another guy. This guy's a fraud. And another said, well, listen, I've bought 5 yoke of oxen. I am going to test them. So I ask you to have me excused. Here's another excuse. But this one's all based on fraud. What's the problem again? I. There it is again. You see, if you had 1 yoke of oxen in those days, you were a rich dude. Okay? You had big bucks. What is this guy? He just bought 5. This guy's a millionaire. Okay? And yet he says, and I am going to test them. So here's a man with the means to purchase 5, of which even the person that has is well-to-do only has 1. But he needs to be the one to go and test them. Right. This is one of those dudes who wouldn't have dirt under his fingernails if his life depended on it. He had plenty of people to test out his oxen. This is fraud. He's making it up. Well, then there's another guy. I call this guy the phony. Here it is again. Still another said, I have married a wife. So you and I both know, friend, my life is over. So excuse me. Right? No, that's not what he's saying. I have married a wife and therefore I cannot come. She said, I can't come. You phony. What a joke. Bring your wife, dude. You're married now. In that culture, you could have brought your wife. And even if not, it's a dinner, for goodness sake. Okay? Bring her a doggy bag home if she don't want to go. What a bunch of nonsense. But do you see the point? God has sent the invitation through the Son to all of these people seated at this table. This is still in this guy's house, still to the religious. But you guys make excuse after excuse after excuse as to why you won't come to the kingdom. Sound familiar? Well, you may not have bought a piece of land that you know to check out. But where are you foolishly putting something above the kingdom? Maybe you didn't buy 5 oxen. Or if you did, you probably live in scenic. But maybe you didn't buy 5 oxen. But you just have to go and see the thing you purchased. Do you see? Do we not do the same thing? I've got a wife and I've got a family and I would really love to commit to the church, but working all day and coming home and I'm tired of the kids. Rick, I just can't do it. Sound familiar? Yeah, I did it for years. Just can't do it. You got to excuse me from the kingdom, Lord. Right now, I've got so much on my plate. That, 18 to 20, is you and I, for the most part. You see, with the kingdom is your priority. You don't have to ask. You don't have to be invited. You're going to want to be joining and be a part of it. As Blackabee says, find out where God is working and join it. If you can't see God at work here in this fellowship, you should probably open your eyes. There's plenty of invitations to be involved in what God is doing here. And our focus, the root of this church, is the kingdom of God. Period. Nothing more, nothing less. So the invitation goes out. Well, now there's reward and then rebuke is the last part of this. So that servant, the son, then comes and reported these things to his master, the father. Then the master of the house being angry. Notice he's being angry. He didn't become angry. He's not angry with the people. He's angry because what he has done is going unheeded. It's going unheard. God doesn't get angry. It doesn't say, and God got angry, and this master got angry. He was angry, but what he was angry with is that the promise and the provision that he had provided was being rejected. God doesn't get angry with sin, folks. He abhors sin because it keeps us apart from him. And so he said to his servant, well, then listen, go out quickly into the streets and the lanes of the city. Now, to the Pharisees, that's why Jesus said this, the lanes and the streets were where the derelicts hung out. They knew he was talking about the kingdom. The guy just said it. Wait a minute. You're saying that the servant was sent to the derelicts, the people that we don't even want coming into our synagogue? That's exactly what he's saying. But there's more. In the lanes and city, and bring them in here. The poor, the lame, the maimed, the lame, and the blind. Sorry, I said that twice. This was to the Pharisees, as I've already pointed out, this was those who were under the condemnation of God. You're in sin. That's why you're the way you are. Your mother, when you were born, you're steeped in sin. Ay, ay, ay. But that's where God says to go get them. And the servant said to the master, it is done as you have commanded. In other words, it's going out. I've gone. Notice it's all within the city. It's the streets of the city where the derelicts are, the lame, the blind, and stuff within the city. But now notice what the master said. Then the master said to the servant, go into the highways. Now the highways for them, like us, were those that started in the city but went out. In other words, so the invitation now has to go beyond the city boundaries. Go out into the highways and the hedges. The hedges were those bushes along the road where people, the homeless, would stop at those hedges to find shelter from wind or rain or whatever. So he's saying, so then now go outside the city and get that. Get those people. And notice, and compel them to come in. Don't drag them in. Compel them. Persuade them. Try to convince them what awaits for them if they'll just heed the invitation. Compel them to come in so that my house may be filled. Folks, we are still asked to do this. It's why we go to Africa. It's why we go to Belize. It's why we went to Nepal and Thailand and Nairobi. And we could go on and on. It's why we do it. Because there are still out there those on the highway and in the hedges, the lame, the blind, the mute, the derelicts who haven't heard. So we will go. Because the invitation still stands. For I say to you that none of those who were invited, who were the ones that were invited, who was to receive the Messiah and take the Messiah to the world? At that point in time, within the history of Israel, it was to be the Pharisees. Obviously, they failed. It was to be the scribes. It was to be the Sadducees. Jesus would condemn them, will condemn them later as he actually enters the city of Jerusalem. But the course has been set. They have chosen the path. The invitation still stands. Go. At the end of Matthew's gospel, we have Jesus giving us what we call the Great Commission. In Matthew chapter 28, and Jesus says, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Go, therefore. Go. And make disciples of what? All nations. The highways, the hedges, the lame, the blind, the poor. Make disciples of all nations. Teaching them all things. And lo, I am with you. Now, I missed some of the barbecue. We're running out of time. Okay? And I'm going to go with you to do it. Isn't that cool? So we look at this and we say, ah, those rotten Pharisees. But the reality is that we're really not a whole lot different, are we? When the invitation goes out to join the work that God is doing here, to reach out to the highways, the hedges, the poor, the blind, the meek, then everybody can be involved in that, because this is God's work. It's not Rick's work or Kenny's work or anybody else's work for that matter. It's His work. It's what He's asked us to do. You see, to shirk the invitation of God is to find that last verse. They will not, I will not allow those in that I have invited. Scary thought. Especially if you were these guys. Now, did they learn from this? No, they didn't. They didn't. See? Their recreation, their homes, their cars, their whatever, was their retirement, was more important to them than the kingdom. The invitation has gone out, is going out, and will continue to go out. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, what excuse will we use to turn away from the invitation? Only you can answer that. Only I can answer that. But the invitation still stands. Amen? All right, let's stand. We'll close in a word of prayer.